हरि ओम सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तमविद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासरि गौर भक्त वृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay, second meaning of the verse. There's another meaning to the introductory verse by a play on words. The double meaning of words indicates a comparison, and by that, the meaning of the verse is further enhanced. Though the subject of rasa is far beyond all common and extraordinary matters, people's intelligence will comprehend it only by comparing it with specific material object. Right? Because that's how things work, is that even though you're dealing with the spiritual, you have to compare it to some material object so you can relate to it. That's just how the thought process works. It means when you're dealing with trying to understand something, you're comparing it to something. You're comparing it to what's known. That's why it's important when you're talking or discussing someone something, then you're discussing it according to something that they know. Therefore, familiar language to them, examples, environments, moods, those kind of things. Like we can see, it's just a difference on where the acharyas are speaking, what kind of moods and that they're using. Though the message is exactly the same. Yes. Right?
That's what we call our frame of reference?
Yes, your frame of reference and all that. So that's what you're doing. You're taking Vedanta philosophy, and then according to a frame of reference, then you're delivering that to people. The idea is that the message is the secondary words, and then therefore we have to change the words, and then the primary is not being part of it. So since the primary wasn't so much part of it, the secondary words, you change the words, then now you only have a different secondary and still no primary. But they keep the primary always intact. Then they may adjust the words to where, even like you see Bhaktivinoda Thakura here, no Sanskrit. Very, very elaborate words or phrases. Srila Prabhupada will do the same thing, minimal Sanskrit. And but he'll explain it, but he'll use phrases in that are more accessible, you know, in the present. Like, you know, so like a few of those, we would read the sentence, that little paragraph, and it was kind of like, okay, I got the if, I got the and there was a but in there, and yeah. Oh yeah, there was a the. Yes, yes, okay, you know. Right. So that's then what's up. No? Okay.
Okay. From our life is why it's very important to be connected with the primary always.
Yes. If you're connected with
always.
Yes, if you're connected with the primary, then you see the mood and what the person is, then you'll approach an example so that they appreciate it. Right? Because the point is words are for communication, but the words aren't the communication. What the thought that you have, that's what you're communicating. So that thought has to be Krishna. Then the particular words you use, then you use that to communicate. Does that make sense? So, you know, sometimes I say, okay, you're learning English, or you're learning French, or you're learning Italian. But the thing is no, you're learning how to communicate through that. Because it's thought, okay, let's say if I learn French, then, you know, I'll be so much more suave. No, but if you're not suave, then it doesn't matter. Yes. That was correct word?
Huh?
Yeah, come on. Prabhupada said, he says, English is for talking to, I think, horses. French is for talking to women. German for talking to dogs. And Italian for talking to God. Yes, English for horses. Right? You know, there's English and their horses. They're really into their horses, right? Yes.
Can we go a little deeper? We say connect with thought. Can we say we connect through our consciousness first, and then?
Yes, it means the consciousness is there, because we have to remember when sound, as we said before, is that first it's a concept. That concept there is in nod, right? Connect with the first chakra. Then when it moves up to the third chakra, it takes on, means then there'll be kind of a direction to it in the second. And the third chakra takes on the activity of it. But that activity has to be expressed. And coming to the fourth chakra, then it takes on the form of a noun. Then when it comes to the fifth, you express that. So that means we're taking it that the words are the language, but actually, you know, it's the thought that's the language.
Yes.
And so if you have nothing to think about, there's nothing to talk about. You know, it's not that if I know language and know fancy words, I know logic and that, I'll have something to say. That's why you see the acharyas, whether they know logic or not, they can always express.
Yes.
Right? That's the whole point that's there. So that's a very important aspect, is that if you have the content, if you know Krishna, you know everything, because you can explain it. That's why the first class devotee, he can't be defeated in an argument, because he knows what he's talking about. Well, the others are just going on feelings that they have driven by the modes. So they'll talk in a particular way, but they don't necessarily know what to do with it. You know, you can be trained so you can think more and more analytical. They'll be more careful, but they still, just because they have that tool doesn't mean that they know what they're doing. Like I take someone who's a neophyte cook, I give him the most excellent kitchen, it doesn't mean he's any better of a cook. You know, it just means that his bad preparation didn't stick. That's all it means. Well, normally it would stick and burn, but you know, that's just, you know, and that might have been the only flavor that was there in what he cooked, but you know. So, yes.
Maharaj, some preachers, they use a lot of Sanskrit to give it more authority.
Yeah.
Is that a...
It's fine if it works. It's very individual, because you're dealing with individuals. What the comment was on the point that to this idea that we have to adjust the preaching in our presentation, so we can't talk about Krishna, we can't do this. No, you can always talk about Krishna, because everything is Krishna. But the point is if you know the philosophy, then you just explain Krishna in those words of that context that you're working in. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, like that. So this idea of soft preaching means that since it's not so much about the primary, it's about the secondary, they adjust the words in the secondary and then think it's preaching. But sometimes it's not. You know, if you're giving a whole, your whole program is, let's say, on Ayurveda or astrology or, being vegan or something like that, the point is where's Krishna in it? And so if you're just depending upon the words, then there's a good chance you won't have. But now if you're focused on Krishna and then how he is everything, so you can explain him at any point. You know, that's what's being discussed in 11th Canto. Right? So you can always discuss him and then relate it to the person you're discussing it to. So there's no question of preaching not being discussing Vedanta. It's just that what wording you'll use. Does that make sense? So in the Vedic, there's no such thing as hard preaching, soft preaching. It depends upon who you're talking to. So it adjusts according to the audience, not according to what you're saying. Does that make sense? So it's just the flavor of it. Like here you see is that it's going into, means we saw, not as much now, but Jiva Goswami is making a very analytical presentation, word by word. So that means that discussion in the first one was... four and a half pages, just on that first verse describing the words. But even though it is full and analytics that you see in Nyaya Prashtan, did you ever feel that it had that academic kind of flavor? No. So that's the thing, is that because of the language he uses, but the technicalness that he got into it and the level of grammar and all that was more technical than anything we've seen before. Right? But because of the language, how he's using it, even though he's discussing such technical points, it does not come off as academic. Right? It's not scholarship. Right? So therefore, in journals and different things that you read that have that flavor, that's because that's the flavor they want. They don't have to put it in that flavor. But it's just that there's a certain taste. You know, it's just like the rich man, he has a certain attitude, you know, of, how you say, self-entitlement. And that's what makes him feel good. You don't have to have that. You can be rich and not have that mood. So you understand? So in the same way, the academic, they have that mood. Or the scholar, he has that mood. You know, just like the karmi has his mood, the jnani has his mood. And so that's the flavor they want to get. So the wording and the topic is just to, as for a point to discuss that flavor. You know what I'm saying? The modern academic, they don't want conclusions because it's not about the topic. It's about that flavor, that taste that they get from that academic approach. Does that make sense? So that's what is being, that's the actual point. And as long as they can get that flavor, then they consider it good. So it's not about the content. It's about how it was discussed so that flavor was tasted. So then we see for the acharyas, Krishna is the flavor. So then their discussion, Krishna will always be brought out. You know what I'm saying? And they can make it accessible to any level. Right? While generally we see is, for most, they're expert in their field. And so experts can only talk to people who are expert or are potentially expert. You know, quite well trained. They can't talk to people below that or above that. You know what I'm saying? It's like middle management. They can function amongst themselves. They only like each other. Everyone above them and below them doesn't like them. You know, because the way they deal and everything like that. You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole point when the acharyas are talking about going beyond upadis. We don't have the upadi that I'm a scholar or I'm a big manager or I'm, you know, such a nice guy or anything like that. They're going beyond these upadis. By going beyond the upadi, then they can actually just be a servant of Krishna. So then it's all about Krishna, the situation you're in. Then they can explain that Krishna consciousness to whoever they are in the situation they are, because it's just about Krishna. Does that make sense? So that's the whole point we're bringing here. So even though it's very, you could say very scholarly, but the flavor of it doesn't have that upadi to it. It doesn't have that mundane aspect. So it's not dry. Does that make sense? Yeah. Thus, comparison can be made to some degree, taking into consideration some similar aspects of the object of comparison. Right? Just to some degree, because any material object will never perfectly explain something spiritual. But it's close enough that you can, right? Just like the example given of the tree and the moon. It's just the proximity that's important. You know a tree, you know it has branches, you can go, okay, go up to that, you know, the second branch, okay, on the left there, then take that and go all the way to the end there, okay, and then when you get to the end where the leaves are, yeah, there's some space, yeah, and then there's this big, round, white ball, kind of light, yeah, that's the moon. So it's just enough that you can get to the moon. It's not about the tree. But we discuss the tree, how much we need to get to the moon. Is that? Yeah. Okay. So then that second one then is the full moon, which destroys suffering and creates happiness by its cooling rays, shines everywhere with excellent qualities and beauty. It is the very form of nectar, filled with all tastes. It eclipses the host of stars by its light, accepts the playful gestures of the night, and fondly enters the Vishakha constellation in the spring season. So it's enhancing the previous one. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's bringing out Krishna, the destroyer of sin and bestower of all bliss. So the full moon is the one that brings happiness, right? Destroys suffering, right? Because that's sin. And creates happiness, that's the bliss, by its cooling rays. So it's by his beauty. Right? And then you'll see the comparison. Eclipses the host of stars by its light. So therefore, or is it Taraka and Palika? Right? So those are stars also. And then, except the playful gestures of the night, you know, so Shyamala is dark and Lalita always wears the peacock feather, you know, the dark blue of that. And then Radha, and pleasure to, and then enters the Vishakha constellation in the spring season. Because the Vishakha constellation is there, but it's also, that's another name sometimes also we see is that Vishakha is compared to Radharani because they appeared at the same moment. They're the exact same age. Everyone else is older or younger, but they're exactly the same age. Yes.
Who is giving the second name?
Jiva Goswami. We're still in Jiva Goswami's point of yeah. That first, the first 4.5 pages was explaining the first. Now he's explaining the second one. In the previous discussion concerning the derivation of the word Vidhu, it was concluded that the word connotated the ability to destroy all suffering arising from pain and ignorance, darkness, and to bestow all happiness. The same abilities apply to the full moon, which is the other conventional meaning of the word Vidhu. The moon in it, because he showed how Vidhu and all those qualities it had was compared to Krishna. Right? And so now he's showing also in a very standard context, it also refers to the moon. The moon in its aspect of fullness, full moon, when it spreads its beauty everywhere, is comparable to Krishna, who is the full manifestation of all qualities of God, spreading his beauty everywhere. Other objects, like the sun, not having the same qualities, are not suitable objects of comparison. Right? Because you think of that pleasant rays and all that. The sun you can't stare at, right? Because it's grandeur, it's greatness. But the moon, then that is something else. Thus, the meaning of Vidhur Jayati is, quote, the full moon destroying suffering and creating happiness, shines everywhere with its excellence, qualities, and beauty, end quote. The present tense is used to indicate the same actions of the full moon every spring season, right? It's used in, because if we use past or future, means it was there, that means the present means every spring season. So it means he's always like that, eternally, because that's an important aspect. The similarity of the subjects of the comparison, Krishna and the moon, has been shown. The similarity of attributes will be shown next. The orb of the moon, Murtihi, is composed of nectar, Amrita, in which there is relish and relish alone, Akila Rasa. Footnote 25. In the scriptures, the moon is said to be composed of nectar and it sprinkles it on the earth. Right? But, depending upon where it is, the Chakora birds, they eat that nectar before it gets down here. Because they only live off of that. Like that. not Chakrabaka, they're different. Chakoras. So I'm not sure if we've even seen Chakoras.
Chakora,
they died.
It subsists upon rain cloud?
Yes, that, and they also eat all that. And they rain, they only drink water that falls from the clouds, but they also eat this nectar. So they're in a different category. Chakrabaka, the water birds, you hear? Sometimes they get going and it sounds like, you know, you're out in the African savanna or something. Those are chakrabakas. The wagtails. You'll hear about them a lot also in the pastimes. Using the same words to describe the moon and Krishna, there's a comparison of another aspect of the moon, its pleasing nature. To the pleasuring nature of Krishna, the full moon covers Rudha, the host of stars, Taraka Palihi. with its effulgence, right? Because then, you know, these different names that they have, then, you know, the stars, maybe some other, it's always something beautiful. Feminine names are always something very nice, like that. Which spread everywhere. Prasrimara ruchihi. This aspect of the moon, which eclipses the presence of other beautiful objects by its beautiful rays, is suitable for comparison with the two beloved gopis who Krishna controls by his beauty, which spreads everywhere. The moon receives Kalita, the amorous charms of the night, Shama Lalita. Right? Because they're the charms of the night. Does that make sense? But they're also the friends. Like that. And so in this way, because of that friends, then they deal in a particular way. Because you're going for how he's covering, how then the friendship is there. Right? The aspect of the moon embracing the beauty of the night is suitable for comparison with Krishna consorting with Shama and Lalita. Vishva Prakasha says, Shama tu gugulau aprasutang ganayam cha tata soma latau sadhau trivrita sharika gundra nisha krishna priyangushu Shama means the name of a particular family, a woman who has not given birth. The medical soma plant, so we also see connected to the moon. The trivarta plant, a species of bird. The gundra plant, night, black, and the priyangu plant. The moon is most affectionate, so in that way you can use it there. Let's say we use a word in poetics. We just use it because it sounds good. Mm. Shiva Goswami uses it because it sounds good, and then he'll give you half a page of grammar showing how it's exactly correct, down to the syllable. Right? So that's why we said before that Ramanuja Pandit said you cannot juggle Jiva Goswami's language. It's so exact. Mm. Like that. The moon is most affectionate to the constellation called Vishakha, Radha Prayan. This means that during the spring season, the full moon enters Vishakha constellation and becomes famous for its beauty at that time. Footnote 26. The moon enters each of the 27 constellations every month, but the full moon will enter one constellation every month. In the spring season, the full moon, in ancient times at least, was situated in Vishakha constellation, right? And slowly everything adjusts a little bit as it goes. The name of the month Vaishakha, is derived from this phenomenon. So Vaishakha means we've just had Falgun, then, I think, what is it, Chaitra, and then Vaishakha. So it's we just had the full moon, so after the next full moon, that'll be Vaishakha. Right? That's also, I think, when the Akshay means the Akshay Tritiya, the Chandan Yatra, like that. So it's also considered a very special month. So, he's saying before is that the moon goes through the whole phase. It goes through all, in 1 month of the moon, it goes through all 27 nakshatras. But it only goes through one nakshatra per month as a full moon. Right? Because it'll be one day as a full moon, and so which nakshatra that's in, then that's the one that's full. So, after 27 months, then he'll have gone through all of them. So, he's giving the comparison of when the full moon goes into the Vaishakha constellation in the spring. So, the spring is special, Vaishakha constellation is special, the Vaishakha month is special. Right? Does that make sense? This aspect of the full moon, having known that his full glory can be revealed only by approaching the Vishakha constellation, is comparable to Krishna knowing that his full glory is revealed only by approaching Radha. Because Krishna is everything. And as the ashraya of, being rasa, then a particular aspect of his person, you know, his subjective personality, will only be known by the ashraya that is approaching. Does that make sense? Like Mother Jashoda, she has the full flavor of the Vatsalya Rati. Right? Because she has that full Vatsalya Rati, then she is able to draw that full manifestation of Krishna as a child. No one else can do that. That's why everyone else in Vatsalya Rasa then serves her. Because then it's that full flavor, then with some specific, ornaments being brought out at a time. You know what I'm saying? It's like if you have the full meal and you add some things to it, then it's nice. But if I have the full meal and all I have is a nice set of, you know, china or some crystal glasses or some good silverware, but no meal, then what's the point? So it's just as to adding to that. Does that make sense? So therefore, seeing Braja Krishna, that's only seen when there's Braja Radharani. No one else will see that. You cannot see that. As jivas, we cannot see that. We are infinitesimal. Krishna is unlimited. Where you will draw that aspect? That's another aspect of weakness in the Sahajiya's ideas, that you're dealing with Krishna directly. What you'll see, we're 1/10,000th the tip of the hair. Right? So, therefore, when you have Srimati Radharani, then, in comparison, she's like Mount Meru. Mm-hmm. All other gopis are like a mustard seed. And that means all of them. So, if you have Mount Meru plus a mustard seed, then that's you're adding something. But you're adding something to Mount Meru. But now, if you don't have Mount Meru, you just have a mustard seed. You know, so all glory to all these great personalities. But the point is being brought out here by Rupa Goswami, that it's only when that you see that full glory of the full moon in that Vaishakha season, meaning because of the connection with Radha. So when she's there, then you see Braja Krishna. Then you can assist in that. Therefore, Shyamala, Lalita, Vishakha, such prominent gopis, they all then serve under Radharani. Then they're seeing that same Krishna. Chandravali never sees that Krishna. She will see a different mood. But Braja Krishna, as we are given by the Acharyas, Chandravali won't see. She can't see. Because being the ashray of her particular flavor, Krishna will manifest to her in a different way. Unique, special, but it will be different. That's why it's very specific that when we say we're following, Lord Chaitanya through Rupa Goswami, down through Acharyas and under Prabhupada, we have to stick to it. Otherwise, you're going to see something else. This idea is, oh, as long as we're somewhere in the Gaudiya family, it's good enough. No, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Another point, sometimes devotees, they are confused about, can the jiva have direct rasa with Krishna?
Direct?
Rasa.
What does that mean, direct rasa? How is they defining it?
We speak about five main.
Yeah.
Seven.
Yeah, it means the five main. Secondary. But what about those five main?
So, our relationship with Krishna, we know it's dasya, according to Lord Chaitanya.
No, it's dasya with Lord Chaitanya.
Yeah. And what about Krishna?
Whatever it is, any of the five.
Because sometimes we say that the jiva will not have direct relationship with Krishna. It's always
no. But what's the point of the direct relationship? I mean, why are they worried about this? Just like this, will you ever have a direct relationship with your grandfather? You'll never have. Your relationship is through your parents. But it doesn't mean that you don't have direct interaction. See, the problem is there a mixing up direct interaction with direct relationship.
Yes.
So the point is, unless I have direct relationship, I'm not getting that direct. No, it doesn't matter. In fact, the relationship with the grandfather is so special because it's not direct.
They're probably mixing those.
They're mixing those. Because, in other words, it's how you say, you have enough knowledge to be dangerous. Yeah, it's not quite enough to be okay, but enough to be dangerous. Yeah. Yes.
Which age are we referring to here in the description?
Probably any age.
Any age.
Any age, but the point is his in dealing with Radha, so that's most likely we're talking here Kishore, because that's when it's in its full manifestation. Krishna interacting with Radharani and the other gopis will happen in the other aspects. But you don't see so much about that. You generally see Krishna and the gopis starting with the rasa dance when he comes into the Kishore age. And so then that's the time when this, the that blooming youth and that kind of aspect like that. It's not youth, it's that before that. Yeah, because youth then is when he goes to Dwarka. That's youth. Vaikuntha, that's youth. But this is just before that. So that's generally when it would be. That's when you see the full manifestation. So, yeah.
So for the Sanskrit, can we say that the word in Sanskrit can have different meaning according to the situation?
Yes,
to
yes.
The mood, to the,
yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's just like we're used to using the language and just using it.
Yes.
But if one's educated very nicely in the language, you know the other the derivatives of the word. Like sometimes, you see much time in the dictionaries that they'll show the word back to its roots in Latin or in Greek or something, you know? And so then when you see that, you know more of what you're dealing with, so you can give it a fuller meaning. So then in Sanskrit, it takes it not back just to that root word, but back to the syllable that it's from. Like you saw, he built the word vidu from the syllables up, or priya, from the syllables up to then the word and then its specific application. Like that. Because basically speaking, most all roots go back, they're all verbs. They're something that does something. Then you have to have something that does that. That's the noun. So how it converts from that root into the noun and then its specific application, then that's... So they know it to the point for simply expressing and talking about Krishna. So that's why even though it's so technical, it still has a sweetness. While those who are scholars, they tend to know the knowledge very nicely, but it's about the knowledge, it's not about what they're describing. You know what I'm saying? Like when you say someone's a scholar, it generally is meaning that they have that kind of knowledge and that kind of explanation. It's not necessarily what they're talking about. Unless you say he's a scholar in this or a scholar in that, then it's about that, and then he may have, you know, some affinity towards that. But for the Vaishnava scholars, we see is about Krishna, and so the degree that, and even they don't know any of this. Like the gopis, they can speak very nicely, but then if they train in the grammar, then they can explain it more because they know Krishna. So that's why then. When Prabhupada says Jiva Goswami is the foremost scholar in the contemporary age, he means that. He doesn't just mean amongst the Gaudiyas. Yes. He doesn't mean just amongst the Vaishnavas. He doesn't mean just amongst the Vedic scholars. He just means in general. Mm-hmm. You know, in the contemporary age, which we would count basically in this from the time of the Greeks, mm-hmm. you know, here. Because otherwise you don't need to say it for India. Mm-hmm. So then he's the greatest scholar that there's ever been. Mm-hmm. And Prabhupada says he is, so that doesn't mean he was, he is. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's there, and you see is, but it's all about just describing Krishna, bringing out that taste, that rasa in Krishna. That's it's not about something else. Yeah? In the comparison using specifically the moon, the descriptive elements are superior to those of other objects for expressing the qualities of Krishna. For instance, the sun and other objects do not possess such forms as the moon, full nectar. Right? The sun we use when we talk about purifying and grandeur and authority and these things. And the sun lacks the beauty of the moon in comparison with the stars, since the sun causes the stars to disappear. But when the moon's there, it's the prominent, but you still see the stars. So then there's still interaction, but it's still the prominent. As well, the sun lacks the accompanying of the amorous night, which gives rise to a particular happiness, and does not manifest such fame as the moon. So when it comes to these beauty and the amorous aspect, it's the moon, not the sun. Right? Sun is, you know, getting rid of ignorance and darkness and revealing and purifying. And so when you use those examples, then you use the sun. But when you're talking about beauty and relationships, then you talk the moon. Right? So. Here the word insurmountable, dirgama, is used in describing the commentary because the text of Sri Rupa employs extraordinary ornaments and allusions in abundance for describing the states of rasa. Whatever I've written, however, should completely dispel doubts in the text. The unintelligent should not reject this commentary, fearing that it is useless to try to understand the text. Right? Because you have the elements, the sahajis, that they, oh, we don't get into, that's all into, that's yan, we just rasa, like that. So, for those fools, then, he's making this point. I, to comply with the intentions of the author, have rejected some of the alternate readings of the text, because right? They might be others than this. He's rejected those. He's keeping these two. One should not think that this is objectionable, but rather one should consider it the author's desire. Because right? He's a disciple of Rupa Goswami, so therefore he knows.
Right.
Yes?
So this thing is, the text is from Rupa Goswami and the rest is from Jiva Goswami and Srila Prabhupada?
Yes. 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 Or whoever it comes up, but it's like that. But that's the point here. Where is it going here? Text 112, translation. I offer my respects to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord in the form of Chaitanya Deva. Though I am a vile person by nature, by his inspiration within my heart, I have undertaken this work. Srila Jiva Goswami. In this verse, the author offers his respects to the avatar who delivers the people of Kali Yuga by spreading devotion to himself, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Deva, the Supreme Lord, and particularly to his lotus feet, which have become his shelter. Quote, by his inspiration within my heart, I have been able to accomplish this work, end quote. He addresses himself as Lo, Varaka, Rupa, out of humility. Saraswati, however, cannot tolerate that. Therefore, she produces another meaning. Vara also means the best. A combined with ka becomes akayati, which means boldly indicates. Therefore, Varaka stands for varam akayati. She praises him as, quote, the person who is clearly indicated as the best. End quote. The word api in the verse indicates that only by the inspiration of the Lord and not otherwise will a person be able to dedicate himself to writing a worthy literary work. Right, so it's only by the Lord's grace. So Rupa Goswami has been directly instructed by Lord Chaitanya and now taking those instructions and making them into this work by the desire of Lord Chaitanya, then it's there. So he's considering himself as just as lowly. But the term he used to make it to fit nicely in the verse, and if you take it out of its standard meaning, then it would mean what he's thinking. But as Jiva Goswami points out, that Saraswati Devi, by her influence, then the words used, if you understand the depth of it, then you understand that it means just the opposite. Right? Yeah. So, but the point is it's only by Lord Chaitanya's grace that worthy books can be written. 113. May this work named the Ocean of Nectar the Ocean of Nectar composed of Bhakti Rasa, end quote, always serve as the recreation hall of my Lord manifested in the form called Sanatan Goswami for his pleasure. Srila Prabhupada. Srila Rupa Goswami begins his great work by offering his respectful obeisances unto Sri Sanatan Goswami, who is his elder brother and spiritual master. And he prays that Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu may be very pleasing to him. He further prays that by residing in that ocean of nectar, Sri Sanatan Goswami may always feel transcendental pleasure in the service of Radha and Krishna. So he's getting the blessings of him and also wishing that he is always residing in that ocean of nectar himself. Right. So in other words, it's not just about getting something, it's a relationship. Right. 114. I offer my respects to the devotees who are like makaras, kings among fish, frolicking in the sweet ocean of devotional rasa, who disregard the insignificant rivers of liberation, and who are free from fear caused by the net of time. So these insignificant rivers, that the rivers are flowing down into the ocean, like that. So the impersonal, they like to stay in the river there before they're not interested in going into the ocean. So these makaras, they just stay in the ocean. They're not interested in that. You know, the salmons, they're interested in that. And then as they go up there, some bear will catch them, and then they'll end up on either the bear eats them or, you know, on a sandwich, right? So therefore, stay in the ocean, right? Right? Srila Prabhupada. Let us offer our respectful obeisances to all the great devotees and acharyas, holy teachers, who are compared to sharks in the great ocean of nectar and who do not care for the various rivers of liberation. Impersonalists are very fond of merging into the Supreme, like rivers that come down and merge into the ocean. The ocean can be compared to liberation, and the rivers to all the different paths of liberation. The impersonalists are dwelling in the river water, which eventually comes to mix with the ocean. They have no information, however, that within the ocean, as within the river, there are innumerable aquatic living entities. The sharks that dwell in the ocean do not care for the rivers which are gliding down to it. The devotees eternally live in the ocean of devotional service, and they do not care for the rivers. In other words, those who are pure devotees always remain in the ocean of transcendental loving service to the Lord and have no business with the other processes, which are compared to the rivers that only gradually come to the ocean. They gradually come there. And they're talking about that merging, that point there, but they don't have no information that what's in the ocean. They think, okay, in the river, then you have all these other things. And so they're trying to get rid of that, merge into the ocean. But the ocean is that's the origin of it. 115. O Sanatana, may your ocean of bhakti ras remain for a long time, restricting the harsh arguments of the proponents of karma and jnana, just as the ocean restricts the flame of the Vadabha fire. Srila Prabhupada. Srila Rupa Goswami prays to his spiritual master, Srila Sanatana Goswami, for the protection of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, quote, the ocean of the pure nectar of devotional service, end quote, from the argumentative logicians who unnecessarily meddle in the science of service to the Lord. He compares their arguments and logic to volcanic eruptions in the midst of the ocean. In the midst of the ocean, volcanic eruptions can do very little harm. And similarly, those who are against devotional service to the Lord and who put forward many philosophical theses about the ultimate transcendental realizations cannot disturb this great ocean of devotional service. So if one's fixed in Krishna, there's no disturbance. Because even though they're intelligent and logical and all these different things, maybe well respected, but it doesn't have anything to do with appreciating and understanding devotional service. Srila Jiva Goswami. He prays to the lotus feet of Guru for the continued presence of his scripture, which will eliminate the criticisms of challengers. The challengers, Mimamsaka, are of two types, those who deliberate on karma and those who deliberate on jnana. Right? So you basically see is that, how do you say, Jaimini, you could say, is purely karma. Right? And then, you know, Shankar and like that, the persons, that'll be the jnana. And the others, then they'll have degrees of mixes. Yes. Like that, yes. Because Mimamsaka is, it means your, what is your philosophy? It means your interpretation.
General.
Mimamsaka is like hermeneutics. So then there's six schools of hermeneutics, or six schools of Mimamsa.
So basically we can call them all like this.
Yes, you can call them all Mimamsakas. Okay. See, in the Vedic system, the philosophical section is the, how do you say, in the Upanga part of the Veda, right? You have the 14 books. So the third section, the Upanga, then where the philosophy is, then the Vedic will call it Mimamsa. That means your how you would interpret the Vedic verses, so the hermeneutics. So for us, we're in the Vedanta school, right? And within the Vedanta school, there's six schools. Then we're in the, you know, school Achinta Veda Veda Tattva. That makes sense. Yeah. So basically, because Mimamsaka is here, then we're talking about the Vaishnavas. Then that means that there are two types, karmis and jnanis. Because that's all there is in philosophy. There isn't something else. Jivam, referring to fire, means a flame as well as a tongue. This flame or tongue is described as belonging to the Vardabha fire. Vardabhagena, no, Vidav Bhagne Jivam. Footnote 27. Under the ocean near the South Pole, a fire from the lower regions emerges from a hole called, quote, the mouth of the mare, Vardhaba. Arva, born in the Bhrigu dynasty, when about to be killed by the sons of Kartavirya, produced a fire out of his wrath. This fire threatened the whole world. The Bhargavas persuaded Aurava to cast it in the ocean, where it remains concealed with the face of a horse. So that's the fire under the ocean. Okay. This flame or tongue is described to belong to the Vaidhava fire. To distinguish it from the well-known seven flames, tongues of the fire, which are used to consume sacrifices. Footnote 28. The seven flames are Kali, Karali, Manojava, Sulohita, Sudhumna, Varna, Ugra, and Pradipta. Just as the, like you say, the seven tongues of the Samkirtan mission. Right? So that's all given in that first verse of the Shikshastakam. Right, you have Cheto Darpan Marjanam, Baba Mahadavagni Nirvapanam, Shreya Kayavi Chandikavitananam, Vidyabadhu Jivanam, Anandam Bhudivardhanam, Pratitam Param Purnamrita Swaranam, Sarvatma Snapanam. So those are the seven tongues. Because the yajna, you know, it means the fire, the sacrifice, then Agni has seven tongues. So these seven tongues are represented by these seven aspects. That Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur describes that. We see here is that Jiva Goswami is also mentioned. Just as the ocean always remains present to restrict the flame of the Vardhava fire, this work, the ocean of Bhakti Rasa, should always remain present to restrict the power of speaking, the tongues of the Mimamsakas. Right? So it should always be brought to devotion. From taking the whole meaning of the verse, it should be understood that his desire is not just restriction, but extreme restriction. Right? Not just, okay, you know, like that, but extreme so that it does not disturb devotion. Complete extinction of their criticisms. So they should have no criticism of devotional service. They want to argue amongst themselves over other points, they can do that. But if it's in consideration of devotional service, it should completely eradicate all criticisms of devotional service. So that's what Prabhupada says, the complete science of devotional service. In the case of the ocean, restriction of the fire occurs because of the ocean's natural possession of huge quantities of water, one type of rasa, or liquid. In the case of the present work, the restriction of the criticism takes place because of the natural sweetness, rasa, of this work. So one is just because it's huge quantity of that. That way it restricts. But here it's because of the sweetness. Then we overcome all the other, you know, approaches of karma and jnana. Like that. It's just so much sweeter, so that's why then one is appreciated. Another meaning is that, by the metaphor, he is pointing out the difference between this work, an ocean of rasa, and the regular ocean. The Vardhava fire is present permanently in the regular ocean. However, he is expecting that somehow or other the protests of the Mimamsakas will be very transitory because of the presence of this work. But it means the fire in the ocean is always there. But he's hoping by this work it will make the criticisms of these Mimamsakas temporary and just pass by. Not that they're always there. It should, by hearing this, then they'll be satisfied and give up all criticism. With that in mind, he makes his request that the work remain permanently. Thus, the meaning of the verse should be, though the ocean restricts the Vardhava fire, but does not extinguish it, may this work somehow completely extinguish the criticisms of the Mimamsakas. You know, so that's the point being made. But, you know, he's presenting it in a very pleasant way. Yeah, we also see here is by his doing this and in regard to Sanatana Goswami, he's writing this on behalf of Sanatana Goswami. He has the ocean of devotion and Rupa Goswami simply writing about it. Right? So that ocean of devotion had by Sanatana Goswami, may that always last, and that would mean that the work that is describing it will also last. And by that, it will remove all the criticism of all other you know, these mimamsikas like that.
And Maharaj Srila Gotami understands perfectly Rupa Goswami. And Srila Gotami understands perfectly.
Yes, he understands what he's saying. Yeah. Okay. But it means, yes. Though I am ignorant, I have undertaken this work concerning Bhakti Rasa, related to Krishna, who is auspicious for the whole world, for the joy of my friends. Right, so he's undertaking this work for the joy of his friends, and it's about Krishna. So Krishna is the most wonderful, and therefore then his friends will be happy. Srila Prabhupada. The author of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Srila Rupa Goswami, very humbly submits that he is just trying to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world, although he humbly thinks himself unfit for this work. That should be the attitude of all preachers of the Krishna consciousness movement. Following in the footsteps of Srila Rupa Goswami, we should never think of ourselves as great preachers, but should always consider that we are simply instrumental to the previous acharyas. And simply by following in their footsteps, we may be able to do something for the benefit of suffering humanity. Footnote 29. By the mercy of the devotees, we receive the mercy of Krishna. Without being empowered by him, nobody can be a successful preacher. This is confirmed in C.C. Antilila 7.11. Quote, the fundamental religious system in the age of Kali is the chanting of the holy name of Krishna. Unless empowered by Krishna, one cannot propagate the Sankirtan movement. End quote. So that humility that's there, that we're always servant of the servant, that's then the mood that is given by the acharyas. That's the mood they practice, that's how they see it, and that's what's handed down. That is the natural position. Yes?
It's interesting that these verbs were spoken by glorifying Lord Chaitanya.
Ah.
And it speaks of humility, but Balabhabhat did not come to Lord Chaitanya in a humble mood.
That's there. But the point is still truth is truth.
Yeah, truth is truth.
So therefore it's a value, it's written in the book.
Yeah.
Like that. You know, it's just like we see the Guru Hamsa prayers. Because of the nature of the presentation and what's being given there and the proper attitude and everything. So it's considered a very, appropriate prayer. But it's not that Daksha himself was necessarily, his purpose was pure devotion. Does that make sense? You know, whether now internally he is a pure devotee and he's just, in the pastimes performing like this or not, that's another thing. But the point is that how he deals and does things, then he takes his job as a prajapati very seriously. So he's situated very nicely in goodness. But there's never really an indication other than these prayers that he's situated in pure goodness. But the prayers are so perfect that therefore they're, just like that, the instructions on Vedanta philosophy at the loss of a relative by Hiranyakashipu to his family members. It's just so perfect. Therefore, it's included because we would use it properly. He's using it for his own purpose. He means, in other words, the only way to cross over the lamentation on the material platform is by Vedanta, and because Hiranyakashipu doesn't want unhappiness in his home. Therefore, to remove that, the only way to do it is by using Vedanta, but it's not to know the Lord; it's just to remove the problem. But the devotees would use the same approach to remove that, to focus on the Lord. Mm. And he does remove it so that he does focus on the Lord. So just problem is he's a bit inimical, but, Yes?
Maharaj, could you elaborate what is real humility, because number of times it's quite a broader range of. So is it like using the varna and ashram properly in the proper model?
No, it's beyond the varna and ashram, because the quality itself is used within that. It means that humility is that you don't think you're the doer. Because Krishna is his potency that's making everything work. He pervades everything. He is everything. And we're able to appreciate this and function within this by approaching the acharyas. So they reveal how that is. So we're simply the servants of the servants, of the Lord. So that's where the humility comes in. Then you can apply that within any of the religious processes. So the processes work very nicely if you use humility. So Lord Chaitanya and the Shikshastaka giving that humility, then it'll work. So that verse is like the core, the essence of religious principles. And then you expand things from there. Right? And so Varnasha is one of the main areas that you would use as a religious process. But also, you know, celibacy, study of scripture, all these different things. You know, Prahlad Mars gives a whole list of them. Right? Does that make sense? Yes.
The dual thing has been, there was this loka a few decades ago, always this coming from even earlier days, that we are not the doers, but we have to act like we are doers. But then at least Sotoma's a little conflicted that idea. What is the real...
No, the point is, in other words, you have to be confident. But just because you're confident doesn't mean you think you're the doer. Confident because the words of the acharyas are real. Krishna's real. His process is real. So we have confidence in that. But we're only bold as a servant of the previous acharyas. Does that make sense?
Just to support what you just said, Maharaj, in a morning walk conversation, Hari Vilaspa will ask you, Baba, what is humility? And Baba turned to him and said, humility is when, beyond any doubt, you know that Krishna is the Supreme Personality. Mm. That's humility.
Yeah. Yeah. Very nice. Very nice.
I thought exactly about the same episode.
Oh, you were going to bring that up. Yeah. Because the point is, if it's Krishna, then we know it's all about Krishna. There's no doubt. So then we're part of his energy, and of the energy of the Srup Shakti, which is unlimited. We're coming from the Tatashta Shakti, which is also unlimited. But we're a transformation of that, and that transformation is the size of 1/10,000 of the tip of the hair. And so then we you know, where's the... how to get puffed up. Because all the names that we've heard about up to now, all these ones are made of that unlimited spiritual energy. Because if you always keep that in mind, then you'll always make everything else, see that in comparison to that. Because it can't be the doer, because it's Krishna's the supreme. Right? Okay, 117. The divisions of the book. In this sweet ocean of bhakti rasa offered to the Lord, four sections, starting with the eastern section, will be expounded one after the other. 118. The eastern division defines the different types of bhakti. This will be discussed in four successive waves, chapters. So he's given it in four chapters. Samanya bhakti, Vaidhi bhakti, Rag bhakti, and Bhava bhakti. Right? Or Bhava and Prema together. But he's given like this. But Prabhupada then broke that up into smaller chapters. So as we know it, so there's 19 altogether. Mm-hmm. But you see in the back of the book, Prabhupada gives what the original chapters are. Mm-hmm. Like that, so you can compare them. Mm-hmm. The first wave, 119, the first wave of the eastern division of the ocean is concerned with bhakti in general. That's Samanya bhakti. The second wave describes sadhana bhakti. Okay, sadhana, okay. That sadhana, so that includes Vaidhi and Rag. That's how he's put together. The third wave describes bhava bhakti. The fourth wave describes prema bhakti. 1110. In the first, that's why you see in Nectar of Devotion when it has, you know, you see the verse, you know, how you say the chapter, and then it's verse like 273. That's because it's so many chapters together that we have in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So, yeah. 1110. In the first wave or chapter, in order to describe clearly the superiority of bhakti to other processes, the unique characteristic of Uttama bhakti will be related, as approved by the acharyas. Right, so when you're describing the Samanya bhakti, you'll describe what is the standard of you know, devotional service, what is Uttama Bhakti and all these, and then the comparison of others connected with that. Because if you're going to talk about Bhakti in its superior position, then you have to talk about Uttama Bhakti. Right? Does that make sense? Because like that. And then the other levels, Madhyam and Kanishtha, are compared to that. You know, and it's close that they're coming to that. That's what gives them their excellence. Okay. Srila Prabhupada. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is divided into four parts. It also gives a... Sometimes the Vedic approach is not always appreciated because of... It just does things in a different... It's a descending process. Well, the modern is ascending. So then you always start with little things and build it all up and all things like that. So in that context, you might give Uttama Bhakti a mention at the end of this whole Samanya Bhakti chapter. But the point is it's about that. So it'll discuss all the aspects that are there. So in Sambandha Gyan, you're discussing the aspects of all aspects of Shankarshan, Prajumna, Adiruddha, and Vasudeva. You're all of that's being discussed, but it's not being applied. It's showing the relationship, what they do, the different things like that. So whatever aspects enough that you understand, so now you could apply or could appreciate the explanation of the application. Does that make sense? So that becomes confusing because they say, oh, all these things are there. But it's only samanya because it's general. It's just giving a general understanding. So that you understand, you have an entrance into the actual topic. Yes. Having done that, then we start with sadhana bhakti, then bhava bhakti, and prema bhakti.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
So, yeah.
If we are not in goodness, we are confused.
If we're not in goodness?
If we're not in goodness, we can be confused. Anyway.
Yes, if we're not in goodness, we can be confused. And even in goodness, without yes. the teacher, Acharya. Without the acharyas, yes. we will also be confused. Yes. Like you see, is that Jiva Goswami gave. You have the original translation, he's giving the alternative, but the other alternatives he's rejected. Because they're just being poetic and doing this and that, but they won't give the exact... The poetics that they use won't actually match with Krishna. They just sound nice, they're clever, and they like to show something, and that there's some... You know, it's just like when you are an enthusiast that there's certain buzzwords. And as long as you use those words, you're very inspired. So then... Others, they like to use these buzzwords. But the acharyas are not so worried about the buzzwords. They're worried about Krishna. Does that make sense? Srila yeah. okay. Prabhupada, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is divided into four parts, just as the ocean is sometimes divided into four parts. And there are different sections within each of these four divisions. Originally, in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the ocean is divided like the watery ocean into east, south, west, and north. Right, so it's going around also clockwise. You start in the east, then you go down and you go around like that. As in the ocean, there are always different waves, either on the eastern side, the southern side, the western side, or the northern side. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu similarly has different waves. In the first part, there are four waves. The first being a general description of devotional service. The second concerns the regulative principles for executing devotional service. And the third wave, devotional service in ecstasy. So you notice here, the regulative principles for executing devotional service. That'll be standard, whether it's Vaidhi or Rag. It's the same regulative principles. Externally, you can't tell the difference between the two. By what they're doing. Moods and that, yes, but what they're doing, no. In the fourth is the ultimate goal, love of God. These will be explicitly described along with their different symptoms. You also see is that when the acharyas, they write their works, because it's poetic, then how they divide it up is also poetic. Yes. Like here it's the ocean and it's four divisions, and then within that it has the waves, so the chapters of the waves. But we see in, I think it's Madhurya Kadambini, then it's cloud banks, and then the so that's the different sections, and then the specific chapters, those are rain showers. So the first shower, second shower, third shower, like that. So they always do a very nice, poetic, you know, very unique kind of. 1111. Ah. Yes. And we came across that before. That's how you can remember it, right? Anyabi lashita shunyam yana karmad yanavritam anukulyena krishnanu shilanam bhaktir utama. The highest bhakti is defined as continuous service or emotions directed towards Krishna, his expansion forms or others related to him, with a pleasing attitude towards Krishna. It should be devoid of desires other than the desire to please the Lord, and unobstructed by impersonal jnana, the materialistic rituals of karma, or other unfavorable acts. Right? So just in case you thought there's anything outside of karma and jnana, those also. Right? In other words, whatever you can dream up, it includes that. Yeah, so here it also says, Krishna, his expansion forms or others related to him. So Krishna, his forms, his energies, his associates, his dham, his pastime, anything. That's then what it's, that's highest bhakti, is continuous service, or, you know, or emotion directed towards Krishna with a pleasing attitude towards Krishna. Srila Prabhupada. The authorized descriptions of bhakti or devotional service following in the footsteps of previous acharyas can be summarized in the following statement by Srila Rupa Goswami. Quote, first-class devotional service is known by one's tendency to be fully engaged in Krishna consciousness, serving the Lord favorably. The purport is that one may also be in Krishna consciousness unfavorably, but that cannot be counted as pure devotional service. Pure devotional service should be free from the desire for any material benefit or sense gratification, as these desires are cultivated through fruitive activities and philosophical speculation. Generally, people are engaged in different activities to get some material profit, while most philosophers are engaged in proposing transcendental realization through volumes of word jugglery and speculation. Pure devotional service must always be free from such fruitive activities and philosophical speculations. One has to learn Krishna consciousness or pure devotional service from the authorities by spontaneous loving service. Yeah. Right, so the whole point is that spontaneous loving service means it's something you want to do. Right? Does that make sense? So now, when that becomes stable, that is how you're viewing, then that will then be called, classified as spontaneous. But the process that you're going to follow, you know, that is given by the acharyas, the sadhana, then that's going to be, now whether you're following it because you have to, or you're following it because you like to or want to, that's the difference. What you're doing is exactly the same. Yes?
So do we follow spontaneous service right from the beginning or not?
The point is it's depending upon your level of realization. That you want to do that, that's the spontaneous aspect, but after that, that spontaneity may not be manifesting. You're then following the rules because they should be done. You know, you see the correctness of it, there's the gratitude towards the Lord, or the Vaishnavas, like that. Spontaneous means you're doing the activity because that's what you want to do. You want to please Krishna in this way. So you see is that there's always a touch of spontaneity in the process, but because it's small, we call it vaidhi. When it becomes prominent, then we call it spontaneous. Is that, yes?
How do you recognize spontaneity, you know, out of attraction to Krishna, and spontaneity as complete mental?
Because it's stable. Means the point is you won't get spontaneity unless there's steadiness. Steadiness means then you've removed the anartas. You've removed the anartas because you have that faith, as you mentioned before, that there's only Krishna. Devotional service then means all other activities are included within it. The benefits of all other activities are included. Right? Because it's not that the activity itself has to be there. Right? You do an activity for a result. So as long as you get the result, are you really worried about the activity? So, if devotional service gives the results of all activities, all processes of religion, by doing this one, why would you need to do all of the others? That faith, that will remove anartas. That will make one steady. Then you can see a manifestation of spontaneity. Or it may come later, like it said, like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur points out, it may come at the stage of bhava. It will come. But the point is you'll see that stableness, you'll see that faith, that conviction, those things. So if somebody's just, you know, is mental, it's obvious they're mental. That's why we have that terminology. Right? Means anybody can see it. Does that make sense? So that's the point. Is that okay?
Can you relate that spontaneity with like enthusiasm, determination, passion?
Enthusiasm, passions, yes, but it's just the point is you're doing it, you don't need the intellectual process to do it. Just like the alarm goes off in the morning, you might have to use your intelligence to get yourself out of bed. Right? So that means it's not spontaneous. But alarm goes off, then you're very happy because now you can go to the temple and see Krishna. And to do that, you want to prepare yourself. So you go to the bathroom, you brush your teeth, you take your bath, you put tilak, fresh clothes, so that you're presentable, and then you go see Krishna. That's spontaneous. You understand? So we have to understand is that the acharyas have given this approach. Others may not. You know, as we explained, when you have married women and they're, let's say, talking to teenage girls about, you know, preparing themselves for marriage, then they'll be talking on a very, you know, pleasant but very realistic platform of the attitudes, the moods, things like that. Right? Now, let's say you have a little bit older teenage girls like that, and they're talking about marriage. They're talking about something completely different. They're talking about the bags, they're talking about this and that and so many other things. But the married women don't talk about that. If you bring it up, they'll mention it, but that's not the main point. So for your acharyas, is that you want to do that. You're not doing it because intellectually you have to get yourself to do it. You're doing it because you want to do it. That's spontaneous. You know, but we put this thing that we create our own religion. No, it has to be this and that, and it's got to be, you know, something about it. It's got to be there. You know, we do that on so many things. Yes, the holy name is there. It can, you know, like that. That, you know, but you know, we'll always give some excuse or why that's not quite there. And oh yes, and this and, but that's not what the acharyas say. You chant the holy name, you're purified. Does that make sense? So we have to be very careful that we don't overlay our own ideas because we think the material world actually has some meaning. So therefore, that devotional process has to have meaning within the material context. It doesn't. It's in its own category. Does that make sense?
It's due to habits.
Yeah, it's due to habits. You know, it's just like you do your service nicely. Whether you dream about that or not, that doesn't matter to us as long as you do the service. But the others, well, you know, unless the dream, unless in the dream you did it like this, and, you know, were you standing on your head? No, I was actually, you know, in a nice armchair. Oh, then it's not actually, you know. We do that. That's the difficulty, is we try to, that's a rope here, where we project our own ideas onto something transcendental. But it's not necessary. It's that simple. You want to do it. You don't require an intellectual process to get there. That's what it is. That's the meaning of spontaneous. You know, on the material platform, we have that. We're hungry. Someone brings some food that we like. We don't need an intellectual process. It's just we want it. You understand? But that's material. That's why it's called rag, right? Material attachment is called rag. So all it is rag bhakti means is that it's about Krishna. That same spontaneity is about Krishna. But it's not a mental state. It's not a whimsical state. It comes because of the natural proclivity of the heart. Does that make sense? So, the point is, it's either there or it's not. So it's not something we have to sit there and talk about it like that. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, well, you know, it's just, you know, am I, you know, 1.75 meters or, you know, this or that. You know, let's measure. You either are or not. No, but, you know, what about if I feel like I am and all that? Well, that, no, you either, well, that's all or you're not. No, but, you know, it's like that, I kind of, you know, but if I count me and my, you know, and the sleeve on my shirt and all that, or if I put my hand above my head, you know, is that, that's what we do. No, it's either you're on the platform or you're not. If you're not, keep practicing Vaidhi. You'll get there. And if you are, then you don't have to ask. It's that simple. That's the point about devotional service. It is that simple. It is that straightforward. We make it into something. You understand? You know, it's like talk shows. There's nothing to talk about, but they have to make something to talk about. Is that make sense? Yeah. But, yeah. No? Okay.
See, considering the point of other day, Raga, Bhakti and all, 14th February 1977, conversations entitled Varnashram system must be introduced. Prabhupada saying that rascals can't finish the 16 down, they're going to chant like Mahaprabhu.
Okay. Okay, Vritti. Devotional service is a practical activity following the authority of Guru Parampara. It is meant for Krishna or his expansions, and it should be done with a positive attitude to give pleasure to Krishna. It should be free of material desires. Now we will see how Srila Prabhupada explains all elements of Srila Rupa Goswami's definition of pure devotional service. 1. Anushilanam. Devotional service is practical activity according to the instructions of the previous acharyas. Huh, okay. So Prabhupada gives a very big purport to this verse. And then most likely after that is Jiva Goswami. Yes. And that probably goes to the end of this book. And Vishwanath Chakravarti also. Okay, yes. We'll be on this for a while. This devotional service is a sort of cultivation. It is not simply inaction for people who like to be inactive or devote their time to silent meditation. There are many different methods for people who want this, but cultivation of Krishna consciousness is different. Right? If you want that, that's yoga, that's all these other things. You can do those things. But devotional service is activity. Right? The particular word used by Srila Rupa Goswami in this connection is anushilana, or cultivation, by following the predecessor teachers, acharyas. Right? So that's the point. You're cultivating the process as given by the acharyas. You can't make up your own. You can't pick and choose, and that why I like this part, I don't like that part. Because then we saw is that what we're doing is then we're using the arohana process, the ascending. Because we're taking, starting from ourselves, and then what we like of this, then we'll take that. And then, you know, whatever it is. It's given by the acharya. If we take it, then we get the benefit. But then the parts that we reject, then what we'll replace them with will simply be ascending. And it won't work. Krishna is not impressed by our ascending process. Right? Yes?
So previously in the Bindu explanation, it was started exactly the same. It's the same term. Does that mean that this is the main term in the verse?
Yes. Because how else do we know what's pure devotional service? How else do we know Krishna? What's pleasing to him? How do we know what is karma and jnana and how to avoid that? Means if all we've ever done is activities in karma and jnana, how do we do an activity that's not karma and jnana? So it all comes because we're cultivating the process by following the predecessor teachers. That's why it said, of all the processes, then you have the five main. Of the five main, then the serving the devotees. That's actually the point. And within that we see is we have to follow the spiritual master. And in that, then Rupa Goswami then says, you have to, through your spiritual master, follow the previous acharyas. Right? So we can't make something up. Prabhupada's given stuff, we have to take it that way. He's given us the principles, apply it into the situation we're in, but see, that's the principle that's applied. But because we don't see how the principle applies and we reject it, or because he's given a specific application that in our situation may need adjustment in the secondary, but because it's different from what the secondary Prabhupada gave, we reject the primary along with the secondary and do whatever we feel like. So this is all quite, it's not very, it won't be effective. Because as soon as you start doing things yourself, you situate yourself on those three lower levels of consciousness. And we know that the higher one of the theism, we're accepting the scriptures. So what we're talking about here in the modern context, they're not even working on that, the highest level of, the higher two levels of the mundane. They're working on the lower two levels. Right? But where devotional service is recommended to start on is that same, there's an overlap. Right? So you have the first, second, third, fourth levels of that mundane consciousness. But in the third level, that's where it's theistic. But we're using real theism because it's about Krishna and pleasing Him. So even though you're dealing with that aspect on that third level, because it's ultimately about pleasing Krishna, it's counted as in approach service to devotional service. It's just a head going by. Does that make sense? So that's the minimum we're starting off. But if in that, and generally most of the problems come up at that point, where the speculation comes up is the inability to appreciate that third level of consciousness and what it represents in its theistic aspect. So we just take the morality, but it's not morality based on Shastra, it's morality based on our feelings. Then it becomes a problem. So that's why you have to follow in the footsteps of the predecessor Acharyas. But you have to know the principle they're talking about. That's why Jiva Goswami can explain, because he knows what Rupa Goswami is talking about. Then in his explanation, then he can get into so much detail. Does that make sense?
It's an interesting, is that Jiva Goswami, he mentions in one of his purports that I interpret the verses by Srila Rupa Goswami in that particular way because I know even better what he does, because I fully understand his mind. So my explanation should be taken as it is. Because mind of Rupa Goswami is very difficult to comprehend.
So he knows what he wants to say.
Yeah.
And so then he'll give that full explanation. Because that's the point we see, is that Rupa Goswami established the process of pure devotional service as given by Lord Chaitanya. But then he leaves it up to the following acharyas to formally establish it. You know, it's just like the mission of Lord Chaitanya was already established by Rupa Goswami, but then it became formalized by Jiva Goswami into the Vishnu Vaishnav Raja Sabha. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Jiva Goswami's explained everything in connection. You see the whole book's about Radha and Krishna. And that's accepted. And so Jiva Goswami, then he writes a book just on proving that Radharani is the Supreme Lakshmi. Because some people contest that. So for us, we're thinking, oh, so much stuff is here. But what they had to deal with was so much more difficult. People not accepting devotional service, not accepting Krishna, not accepting Radharani, not accepting Lord Chaitanya. You know, so they've established all these things. That's why the six Goswamis, that's what they did. They established it. And then based on that, then the Acharyas after them, they make it so that we can appreciate it. And then Srila Prabhupada makes it accessible for us in this time, and that, you know, that accessibility for the next 10,000 years. So... as soon as we say quote-unquote cultivation, we must refer to activity. Without activity, consciousness alone cannot help us. Right? Just like you see in mana, you're talking about you have karma, which is proper activity. You have vikarma, which is bad activity. But also what's not recommended is akarma, means no activity. In other words, you didn't do something wrong, but you didn't do anything right either. So that itself is also considered a weak position. So here, cultivation means it's active. You're doing something for Krishna. It's not that you just have the consciousness and that's enough. You actually have to apply that consciousness. You have to express that consciousness. Because otherwise, if consciousness was enough and that's all it was about, why does Krishna have to expand the creation? Right? Because he's already Atmarama. Everything's perfect. It's just in perfect consciousness. But he expands for the interaction, for the cultivation. Right? So therefore, bhakti means that cultivation. And we wouldn't be here anyway, so then there'd be nothing to discuss. Right? All activities may be divided into two classes. One class may be for achieving a certain goal, and the other may be for avoiding some unfavorable circumstance. In Sanskrit, these activities are called pravritti and nivritti, positive and negative action. There are many examples of negative action. For instance, the diseased person has to be cautious and take medicine in order to avoid some unfavorable illness. Right? So we see is there's the about the positive and negative, so it can't have any material positive and material negative. Right? Does that make sense? No karma and jnana. Because karma means material positive, and jnana means material negative. So all activities come into this. So those who are cultivating spiritual life and executing devotional service are always engaged in activity. Such activity can be performed with the body or with the mind. Thinking, feeling, and willing are all activities of the mind. And when we will to do something, the activity comes to be manifest by the gross bodily senses. Right? Thinking, feeling, and willing, then it will be manifest. Does that make sense? So that's why you have Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojan in there. Sankarshan will be the thinking, the Prajumna will be the feeling, the Aniruddha will be the willing, and then when that's there, then it will become manifest as Abhideya, as Vasudeva. Right? Thus, in our mental activities, we should always try to think of Krishna and try to plan how to please him, following in the footsteps of the great acharyas and the personal spiritual master. Right? So, for us, as we're following the great acharyas, and then we're following, to follow them, we're following the founder acharya. Right? Then, our personal spiritual master, then you can say Prabhupada is our personal acharya, but the personal spiritual master, he gives relevant instructions how to appreciate and understand Prabhupada's instructions that we can apply them into our situation. Like that. Does that make sense? So the founder acharya, the Adi Guru, will always be prominent. Like that. Okay, so end here. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandini.